people were to be resettled there in 7 different ethnic groups. The excuse given by the government was slum clearance, a smokescreen for the government policy that regarded all urban areas as white areas where Africans were temporary residents. The government was under pressure from its supporters in the surrounding areas of West Dean and Newlands, which were comparatively poor white areas. These working-class whites were envious of some of the fine houses owned by blacks in Sophiatown. The government wanted to control the movements of all Africans, and such control was far more difficult in freehold urban townships, where blacks could own property, and people came and went as they pleased. Though the pass system was still in effect, one did not need a special permit to enter a freehold township, as was the case with municipal locations. Africans had lived and owned property in Sophiatown for over 50 years. Now the government was callously planning on relocating all Sophiatown's African residents to another black township. So cynical was the government's plan that the removal was to take place even before the houses were built to accommodate the evacuated people. The removal of Sophiatown was the first major test of strength for the ANC and its allies after the Defiance campaign. Although the government's removal campaign for Sophiatown had started in 1950, efforts by the ANC to combat it did not begin in earnest until 1953. By the middle of the year, the local branches of the ANC and the TIC and the local ratepayers association were mobilizing people to resist. In June of 1953, a public meeting was called by the provincial executive of the ANC and the TIC at Sophiatown's Odin Cinema to discuss opposition to the removal. It was a lively, exuberant meeting attended by more than 1,200 people, none of whom seemed intimidated by the presence of dozens of heavily armed policemen. Only a few days before the meeting, my banning orders as well as Walter's had expired. This meant that we were no longer prevented from attending or speaking at gatherings, and arrangements were quickly made for me to speak at the theater. Shortly before the meeting was to begin, a police officer saw Walter and me outside the cinema talking with Father Huddleston, one of the leaders of the opposition to the removal. The officer informed the two of us that as banned individuals we had no right to be there, and he then ordered his officers to arrest us. Father Huddleston shouted to the policeman coming toward us, "No, you must arrest me instead, my dears." The officer ordered Father Huddleston to stand aside, but he refused. As the policeman moved Father Huddleston out of the way, I said to the officer, "You must make sure if we are under a ban or not. Be careful, because it would be a wrongful arrest to take us in if our bans have expired. Now, do you think we would be here tonight talking to you if our bans had not expired?" The police were notorious for keeping very poor records and were often unaware when bans ended. The officer knew this as well as I did. He pondered what I had said, then told his officers to pull back. They stood aside as we entered the hall. Inside, the police were provocative and contemptuous. Equipped with pistols and rifles, they strutted around the hall, pushing people around, making insulting remarks. I was sitting on stage with a number of other leaders, and as the meeting was about to begin, I saw Major Prinsloo come swaggering in through the stage door, accompanied by a number of armed officers. I caught his eye, and I made a gesture as if to say, "Me?" And he shook his head, "No." He then walked over to the podium, where Yusuf Kachalia had already begun to speak, and ordered the other officers to arrest him, whereupon they took him by the arms and started to drag him off. Outside, the police had already arrested Robert Resha and Ahmed Kathrada. The crowd began yelling and booing, and I saw that matters could turn extremely ugly if the crowd did not control itself. I jumped to the podium and started singing a well-known protest song. And as soon as I pronounced the first few words, the crowd joined in. I feared that the police might have opened fire if the crowd had become too unruly. The ANC was then holding meetings every Sunday evening in Freedom Square, in the center of Sophiatown, to mobilize opposition to the removal. These were vibrant sessions, punctuated by repeated cries of, "We are not moving," and the singing of, "Sophiatown is my home, we are not moving." The meetings were addressed by leading ANC members, standholders, tenants, city councillors, and often by Father Huddleston, who ignored police warnings to confine himself to church affairs. One Sunday evening, not long after the incident at the Odeon, I was scheduled to speak in Freedom Square. The crowd that night was passionate, and their emotion undoubtedly influenced mine. There were a great many young people present, and they were angry and eager for action. As usual, policemen were clustered around the perimeter, armed with both guns and pencils, the latter to take notes as to who was speaking and what the speaker was saying. We tried to make this into a virtue by being as open with the police as possible to show them that, in fact, we had nothing to hide, not even our distaste for them. I began by speaking about the increasing repressiveness of the government in the wake of the Defiance campaign. I said the government was now scared of the might of the African people. As I spoke, I grew more and more indignant. In those days, I was something of a rabble-rousing speaker. I liked to incite an audience, and I was doing so that evening. As I condemned the government for its ruthlessness and lawlessness, I stepped across the line. I said that the time for passive resistance had ended, that nonviolence was a useless strategy and could never overturn a white minority regime bent on retaining its power at any cost. At the end of the day, I said, violence was the only weapon that would destroy apartheid, and we must be prepared in the near future to use that weapon. The crowd was excited. The youth, in particular, were clapping and cheering. They were ready to act on what I said right then and there. At that point, I began to sing a freedom song, the lyrics of which say, "There are the enemies, let us take our weapons and attack them." I sang this song, and the crowd joined in, and when the song was finished, I pointed to the police and said, "There, there are our enemies." The crowd again started cheering and made aggressive gestures in the direction of the police. The police looked nervous, and a number of them pointed back at me as if to say, "Mandela, we will get you for this." I did not mind. In the heat of the moment, I did not think of the consequences. But my words that night did not come out of nowhere. I had been thinking of the future. The government was busily taking measures to prevent anything like the Defiance campaign from reoccurring. I had begun to analyze the struggle in different terms. The ambition of the ANC was to wage a mass struggle, to engage the workers and peasants of South Africa in a campaign so large and powerful that it might overcome the status quo of white oppression. But the nationalist government was making any legal expression of dissent or protest impossible. I saw that they would ruthlessly suppress any legitimate protest on the part of the African majority. A police state did not seem far off. I began to suspect that both legal and extra-constitutional protests would soon be impossible. In India, Gandhi had been dealing with a foreign power that ultimately was more realistic and far-sighted. That was not the case with the Afrikaners in South Africa. Nonviolent passive resistance is effective as long as your opposition adheres to the same rules as you do. But if peaceful protest is met with violence, its efficacy is at an end. For me, nonviolence was not a moral principle, but a strategy. There is no moral goodness in using an ineffective weapon. But my thoughts on this matter were not yet formed, and I had spoken too soon. That was certainly the view of the National Executive Committee. When they learned of my speech, I was severely reprimanded for advocating such a radical departure from accepted policy. Although some of the executives sympathized with my remarks, no one could support the intemperate way that I had made them. The executive admonished me, noting that the impulsive policy I had called for was not only premature, but dangerous. Such speeches could provoke the enemy to crush the organization entirely, while the enemy was strong and we were, as yet, still weak. I accepted the censure, and thereafter faithfully defended the policy of non-violence in public. But in my heart, I knew that non-violence was not the answer. In those days, I was often in hot water with the executive. In early 1953, Chief Latuli, Z.K. Matthews, and a handful of other high-ranking ANC leaders were invited to a meeting with a group of whites who were in the process of forming the Liberal Party. A meeting of the ANC executive took place afterward, at which a few of us asked for a report of the earlier meeting with the white liberals. The attendees refused, saying that they had been invited in their private capacity, not as members of the ANC. We continued to pester them, and finally, Professor Matthews, who was a lawyer, said that it had been a privileged conversation. In a fit of indignation, I said, "What kind of leaders are you who can discuss matters with a group of white liberals and then not share that information with your colleagues at the ANC? That's the trouble with you. You are scared and overawed of the white man. You value his company more than that of your African comrades." This outburst provoked the wrath of both Professor Matthews and Chief Latuli. First, Professor Matthews responded, "Mandela, what do you know about whites? I taught you whatever you know about whites, and you are still ignorant. Even now, you are barely out of your student uniform." Latuli was burning with a cold fire and said, "All right, if you are accusing me of being afraid of the white man, then I have no other recourse but to resign. If that is what you say, then that is what I intend to do." I did not know whether Latuli was bluffing or not, but his threat frightened me. I had spoken hastily, without thinking, without a sense of responsibility, and I now greatly regretted it. I immediately withdrew my charge and apologized. I was a young man who attempted to make up for his ignorance with militancy. At the same time as my speech in Sophiatown, Walter informed me that he had been invited to attend the World Festival of Youth and Students for Peace and Friendship in Bucharest as a guest of honor. The timing of the invitation gave Walter virtually no opportunity to consult with the National Executive Committee. I was keen that he should go and encouraged him to do so, whether or not he conferred with the executive. Walter resolved to go, and I helped him arrange for a substitute passport, an affidavit stating his identity and citizenship. The government would never have issued him a proper passport. The group, which was headed by Walter Sisulu and Duma Nokwe, traveled on the only airline that would accept such an affidavit, the Israeli airline El Al. I was convinced, despite my reprimand from the executive, that the policies of the nationalists would soon make nonviolence an even more limited and ineffective policy. Walter was privy to my thoughts, and before he left, I made a suggestion. He should arrange to visit the People's Republic of China and discuss with them the possibility of supplying us with weapons for an armed struggle. Walter liked the idea and promised to make the attempt. This action was taken purely on my own, and my methods were highly unorthodox. To some extent, they were the actions of a hot-headed revolutionary who had not thought things through and who acted without discipline. They were the actions of a man frustrated with the immorality of apartheid and the ruthlessness of the state in protecting it. Walter's visit caused a storm within the executive. I undertook the task of personally conveying his apologies. I did not mention my secret request. Latuli objected to the flouting of the ANC's code of conduct, and Professor Matthews expressed dismay about Walter visiting socialist countries. The executive was skeptical about Walter's motives and questioned my explanation of the circumstances. A few wanted to formally censure Walter and me, but in the end did not. Walter managed to reach China, where the leadership received him warmly. They conveyed their support for our struggle, but they were wary and cautious when he broached the idea of an armed struggle. They warned him that an armed struggle was an extremely grave undertaking, and they questioned whether the liberation movement had matured sufficiently to justify such an endeavor. Walter came back with encouragement, but no guns. Chapter 18. In Johannesburg, I had become a man of the city. I wore smart suits, I drove a colossal Oldsmobile, and I knew my way around the back alleys of the city. I commuted daily to a downtown office, but in fact I remained a country boy at heart, and there was nothing that lifted my spirits as much as blue skies, the open veld, and green grass. In September, with my bans ended, I decided to take advantage of my freedom and get a respite from the city. I took on a case in the little dorp of Villiers in the Orange Free State. The drive to the Orange Free State from Johannesburg used to take several hours, and I set out on my journey from Orlando at 3 a.m., which has always been my favorite hour for departure. I am an early riser anyway, and at 3 a.m. the roads are empty and quiet, and one can be alone with one's thoughts. I like to see the coming of dawn, the change between night and day, which is always majestic. It was also a convenient hour for departure, because the police were usually nowhere to be found. The province of the Orange Free State has always had a magical effect on me. Though some of the most racist elements of the white population called the Free State their home. With its flat, dusty landscape as far as the eye can see, the great blue ceiling above, the endless stretches of yellow mealy fields, scrub and bushes, the Free State's landscape gladdens my heart no matter what my mood. When I am there, I feel like nothing can shut me in, that my thoughts can roam as far and as wide as the horizons. The landscape bore the imprint of General Christian de Wet, the gifted Boer commander who outclassed the British in dozens of engagements during the final months of the Anglo-Boer War. Fearless, proud, and shrewd, he would have been one of my heroes had he been fighting for the rights of all South Africans, not just Afrikaners. He demonstrated the courage and resourcefulness of the underdog, and the power of a less sophisticated but patriotic army against a tested war machine. As I drove, I imagined the hiding places of General de Wet's army and wondered whether they would someday shelter African rebels. The drive to Villiers cheered me considerably, and I was laboring under a false sense of security when I entered the small courthouse on the morning of the 3rd of September. I found a group of policemen waiting for me. With nary a word, they served me with an order under the Suppression of Communism Act requiring me to resign from the ANC, restricting me to the Johannesburg district, and prohibiting me from attending any meetings or gatherings for 2 years. I knew such measures would come, but I had not expected to receive my bans in the remote town of Villiers. I was 35 years old. And these new and more severe bans ended a period of nearly a decade of involvement with the ANC, years that had been the time of my political awakening and growth, and my gradual commitment to the struggle that had become my life. Henceforth, all of my actions and plans on behalf of the ANC and the liberation struggle would become secret and illegal. Once served, I had to return to Johannesburg immediately. My bans drove me from the center of the struggle to the sidelines, from a role that was primary to one that was peripheral. Though I was often consulted and was able to influence the direction of events, I did so at a distance and only when expressly asked. I no longer felt like a vital organ of the body, the heart, lungs, or backbone, but a severed limb. Even freedom fighters, at least then, had to obey the laws. And at that point, imprisonment for violating my bans would have been useless to the ANC and to myself. We were not yet at the point where we were open revolutionaries, overtly fighting the system no matter what the cost. We believed then that it was better to organize underground than to go to prison. When I was forced to resign from the ANC, the organization had to replace me, and no matter what I might have liked, I could no longer wield the authority I once possessed. While I was driving back to Johannesburg, the Free State scenery did not have quite the same elevating effect on me as before. Chapter 19. When I received my banning, the Transvaal Conference of the ANC was due to be held the following month, and I had already completed the draft of my presidential address. It was read to the conference by Andrew Kuneni, a member of the executive. In that speech, which subsequently became known as the No Easy Walk to Freedom speech, a line taken from Jawaharlal Nehru, I said that the masses now had to be prepared for new forms of political struggle. The new laws and tactics of the government had made the old forms of mass protest, public meetings, press statements, stayaways, extremely dangerous and self-destructive. Newspapers would not publish our statements. Printing presses refused to print our leaflets, all for fear of prosecution under the Suppression of Communism Act. These developments, I wrote, require the evolution of new forms of political struggle. The old methods, I said, were now suicidal. The oppressed people and the oppressors are at loggerheads. The day of reckoning between the forces of freedom and those of reaction is not very far off. I have not the slightest doubt that when that day comes, truth and justice will prevail. The feelings of the oppressed people have never been more bitter. The grave plight of the people compels them to resist to the death the stinking policies of the gangsters that rule our country. To overthrow oppression has been sanctioned by humanity and is the highest aspiration of every free man. In April of 1954, the Law Society of the Transvaal applied to the Supreme Court for my name to be struck off the roll of accredited attorneys on the ground that the political activities for which I was convicted in the Defiance case amounted to unprofessional and dishonorable conduct. This occurred at a time when Mandela and Tambo was flourishing, and I was in court dozens of times a week. The documents were served at my office, and as soon as the application against me had been made and publicized, I began to receive offers of support and help. I even received offers of help from a number of well-known Afrikaner lawyers. Many of these men were supporters of the National Party, but they believed that the application was biased and unfair. Their response suggested to me that even in racist South Africa, professional solidarity can sometimes transcend color, and that there were still attorneys and judges who refused to be the rubber stamps of an immoral regime. My case was ably defended by Advocate Walter Pollock, QC, chairman of the Johannesburg Bar Council. At the time that I retained Walter Pollock, I was advised that I should also retain someone who was not connected with the struggle, as that would positively influence the Transvaal Bar. To that end, we retained William Aronson as instructing attorney, or barrister, who was head of one of the oldest law firms in Johannesburg. Both men acted for me without charge. We argued that the application was an affront to the idea of justice, and that I had an inherent right to fight for my political beliefs, which was the right of all men in a state where the rule of law applied. But the argument that had great weight was Pollock's use of the case of a man called Stridham, who was detained during the Second World War, together with B.J. Foster, who later became Prime Minister. Both were interned for their pro-Nazi stance. Following a failed escape attempt, Stridham had been found guilty of car theft. Later, after he was released, he applied to the bar for admission as an advocate. Despite his crimes and strong objections from the Bar Council, the court decided to admit him on the ground that his offense was political and that a man cannot be barred from practicing as an advocate for his political beliefs. Pollock said, "There are, of course, differences between Strydom and Mandela. Mandela is not a nationalist, and Mandela is not a white." Judge Ramsbottom, who had the case, was an example of a judge who refused to be a mouthpiece for the nationalists and upheld the independence of the judiciary. His judgment in the case completely upheld our claim that I had a right to campaign for my political beliefs, even though they were opposed to the government, and he dismissed the Law Society's application. And in a rare instance, the Law Society was ordered to pay its own costs. Chapter 20. The anti-removal campaign in Sophiatown was a long-running battle. We held our ground, as did the state. Through 1954 and into 1955, rallies were held twice a week, on Wednesday and Sunday evenings. Speaker after speaker continued to decry the government's plans. The ANC and the Ratepayers Association, under the director of Dr. Tuma, protested to the government in letters and petitions. We ran the anti-removal campaign on the slogan, "Over Our Dead Bodies," a motto often shouted from the platforms and echoed by the audience. One night, it even roused the otherwise cautious Dr. Tuma to utter the electrifying slogan used to rally African warriors to battle in the previous century, "The enemy has captured the cattle, you cowards!" The government had scheduled the removal for February 9, 1955. As the day approached, Oliver and I were in the township daily, meeting local leaders, discussing plans, and acting in our professional capacity for those being forced out of the area or prosecuted. We sought to prove to the court that the government's documentation was often incorrect and that many orders to leave were therefore illegal. But this was only a temporary measure. The government would not let a few illegalities stand in their way. Shortly before the scheduled removal, a special mass meeting was planned for Freedom Square. 10,000 people gathered to hear Chief Luthuli speak. But upon his arrival in Johannesburg, he was served with a banning order, forcing him to return to Natal. The night before the removal, Joe Modise, one of the most dedicated of the local ANC leaders, addressed a tense meeting of more than 500 youthful activists. They expected the ANC to give them an order to battle the police and the army. They were prepared to erect barricades overnight and engage the police with weapons and whatever came to hand the next day. They assumed our slogan meant what it said, that Sophiatown would be removed only over our dead bodies. But after discussions with the ANC leadership, including myself, Joe told the youth to stand down. They were angry and felt betrayed, but we believed that violence would have been a disaster. We pointed out that an insurrection required careful planning, or it would become an act of suicide. We were not yet ready to engage the enemy on its own terms. In the hazy dawn hours of February 9th, 4,000 police and army troops cordoned off the township while workers razed empty houses, and government trucks began moving families from Sophiatown to Meadowlands. The night before, the ANC had evacuated several families to prearranged accommodation with pro-ANC families in the interior of Sophiatown. But our efforts were too little and too late, and could only be a stopgap measure. The army and the police were relentlessly efficient. After a few weeks, our resistance collapsed. Most of our local leaders had been banned or arrested, and in the end, Sophiatown died not to the sound of gunfire, but to the sound of rumbling trucks and sledgehammers. One can always be correct about a political action one is reading about in the next day's newspaper. But when you are in the center of a heated political fight, you are given little time for reflection. We made a variety of mistakes in the Western Area's anti-removal campaign and learned a number of lessons. "Over Our Dead Bodies" was a dynamic slogan, but it proved as much a hindrance as a help. A slogan is a vital link between the organization and the masses it seeks to lead. It should synthesize a particular grievance into a succinct and pithy phrase, while mobilizing the people to combat it. Our slogan caught the imagination of the people, but it led them to believe that we would fight to the death to resist the removal. In fact, the ANC was not prepared to do that at all. We never provided the people with an alternative to moving to Meadowlands. When the people in Sophiatown realized we could neither stop the government nor provide them with housing elsewhere, their own resistance waned and the flow of people to Meadowlands increased. Many tenants moved willingly, for they found they would have more space and cleaner housing in Meadowlands. We did not take into account the different situations of landlords and tenants. While the landlords had reasons to stay, many tenants had an incentive to leave. The ANC was criticized by a number of Africanist members who accused the leadership of protecting the interests of the landlords at the expense of the tenants. The lesson I took away from the campaign was that, in the end, we had no alternative to armed and violent resistance. Over and over again, we had used all the non-violent weapons in our arsenal. Speeches, deputations, threats, marches, strikes, stayaways, voluntary imprisonment. All to no avail, for whatever we did was met by an iron hand. A freedom fighter learns the hard way that it is the oppressor who defines the nature of the struggle, and the oppressed is often left no recourse but to use methods that mirror those of the oppressor. At a certain point, one can only fight fire with fire. Education is the great engine of personal development. It is through education that the daughter of a peasant can become a doctor, that the son of a mine worker can become the head of the mine, that a child of farm workers can become the president of a great nation. It is what we make out of what we have, not what we are given, that separates one person from another. Since the turn of the century, Africans owed their educational opportunities primarily to the foreign churches and missions that created and sponsored schools. Under the United Party, the syllabus for African secondary schools and white secondary schools was essentially the same. The mission schools provided Africans with Western-style English language education, which I myself received. We were limited by lesser facilities, but not by what we could read or think or dream. Yet, even before the nationalists came to power, the disparities in funding tell a story of racist education. The government spent about 6 times as much per white student as per African student. Education was not compulsory for Africans and was free only in the primary grades. Less than half of all African children of school age attended any school at all, and only a tiny number of Africans were graduated from high school. Even this amount of education proved distasteful to the nationalists. The Afrikaner had always been unenthusiastic about education for Africans. To him, it was simply a waste, for the African was inherently ignorant and lazy, and no amount of education could remedy that. The Afrikaner was traditionally hostile to Africans learning English, for English was a foreign tongue to the Afrikaner and the language of emancipation to us. In 1953, the nationalist-dominated parliament passed the Bantu Education Act, which sought to put apartheid's stamp on African education. The act transferred control of African education from the Department of Education to the much-loathed Native Affairs Department. Under the act, African primary and secondary schools operated by the church and mission bodies were given the choice of turning over their schools to the government or receiving gradually diminished subsidies. Either the government took over education for Africans, or there would be no education for Africans. African teachers were not permitted to criticize the government or any school authority. It was intellectual baskap, a way of institutionalizing inferiority. Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, the minister of Bantu education, explained that education must train and teach people in accordance with their opportunities in life.
His meaning was that Africans did not and would not have any opportunities. Therefore, why educate them? There is no place for the Bantu in the European community above the level of certain forms of labor, he said. In short, Africans should be trained to be menial workers, to be in a position of perpetual subordination to the white man. To the ANC, the act was a deeply sinister measure designed to retard the progress of African culture as a whole and, if enacted, permanently set back the freedom struggle of the African people. The mental outlook of all future generations of Africans was at stake. As Professor Matthews wrote at the time,
"Education for ignorance and for inferiority in Vervoort's schools is worse than no education at all." The act and Vervoort's crude exposition of it aroused widespread indignation from both black and white. With the exception of the Dutch Reformed Church, which supported apartheid, and the Lutheran Mission, all Christian churches opposed the new measure. But the unity of the opposition extended only to condemning the policy, not resisting it. The Anglicans, the most fearless and consistent critics of the new policy, had a divided policy. Bishop Ambrose Reeves of Johannesburg took the extreme step of closing his schools, which had a total enrollment of 10,000 children. But the Archbishop of the church in South Africa, anxious to keep children out of the streets, handed over the rest of the schools to the government. Despite their protests, all the other churches did the same, and with the exception of the Roman Catholics, the Seventh-day Adventists, and the United Jewish Reform Congregation, who soldiered on without state aid. Even my own church, the Wesleyan Church, handed over their 200,000 African students to the government. If all the other churches had followed the example of those who resisted, the government would have been confronted with a stalemate that might have forced a compromise. Instead, the state marched over us. The transfer of control to the Native Affairs Department was set to take place on April 1, 1955, and the ANC began to discuss plans for a school boycott that would begin on that date. Our secret discussions among the executive turned on whether we should call on the people to stage a protest for a limited period or whether we should proclaim a permanent school boycott to destroy the Bantu Education Act before it could take root. The discussions were fierce, and both sides had forceful advocates. The argument for an indefinite boycott was that Bantu education was a poison one could not drink, even at the point of death from thirst. To accept it in any form would cause irreparable damage. They argued that the country was in an explosive mood, and the people were hungry for something more spectacular than a mere protest. Although I had the reputation of being a firebrand, I always felt that the organization should never promise to do more than it was able, for the people would then lose confidence in it. I took the stance that our actions should be based not on idealistic considerations, but on practical ones. An indefinite boycott would require massive machinery and vast resources that we did not possess. And our past campaigns showed no indication that we were up to such an undertaking. It was simply impossible for us to create our own schools fast enough to accommodate hundreds of thousands of pupils, and if we did not offer our people an alternative, we were offering next to nothing. Along with others, I urged a week's boycott. The National Executive Committee resolved that a week-long school boycott should begin on April 1st. This was recommended at the annual conference in Durban in December of 1954, but the delegates rejected the recommendation and voted for an indefinite boycott. The conference was the supreme authority, even greater than the executive, and we found ourselves saddled with a boycott that would be almost impossible to effect. Dr. Vervoort announced that the government would permanently close all schools that were boycotted and that children who stayed away would not be readmitted. For this boycott to work, the parents and the community would have to step in and take the place of the schools. I spoke to parents and ANC members and told them that every home, every shack, every community structure must become a center of learning for our children. The boycott began on April 1st and had mixed results. It was often sporadic, disorganized, and ineffectual. On the East Rand, it affected some 7,000 school children. Pre-dawn marches called on parents to keep their children at home. Women picketed the schools and plucked out children who had wandered into them. In Germiston, a township southeast of the city, Joshua Makue, chairman of our local branch, ran a school for 800 boycotting children that lasted for 3 years. In Port Elizabeth, Barrett Taisi gave up a government teaching post and ran a school for boycotting children. In 1956, he presented 70 of these children for the Standard 6 exams. All but 3 passed. In many places, improvised schools, described as cultural clubs in order not to attract the attention of the authorities, taught boycotting students. The government subsequently passed a law that made it an offense punishable by fine or imprisonment to offer unauthorized education. Police harassed these clubs, but many continued to exist underground. In the end, the community schools withered away, and parents, faced with a choice between inferior education and no education at all, chose the former. My own children were at the Seventh-day Adventist school, which was private and did not depend on government subsidies. The campaign should be judged on 2 levels: whether the immediate objective was achieved, and whether it politicized more people and drew them into the struggle. On the first level, the campaign clearly failed. We did not close down African schools throughout the country, nor did we rid ourselves of the Bantu Education Act. But the government was sufficiently rattled by our protest to modify the act, and at one point, Vervoort was compelled to declare that education should be the same for all. The government's November 1954 draft syllabus was a retreat from the original notion of modeling the school system on tribal foundations. In the end, we had no option but to choose between the lesser of two evils and opt for a diminished education. But the consequences of Bantu education came back to haunt the government in unforeseen ways, for it was Bantu education that produced in the 1970s the angriest, most rebellious generation of black youth the country had ever seen. When these children of Bantu education entered their late teens and early 20s, they rose up with a vehemence. Several months after Chief Lutuli was elected president of the ANC, Professor Z.K. Matthews returned to South Africa after a year as a visiting professor in the U.S., armed with an idea that would reshape the liberation struggle. In a speech at the ANC annual conference in the Cape, Professor Matthews said, "I wonder whether the time has not come for the African National Congress to consider the question of convening a national convention, a Congress of the people, representing all the people of this country, irrespective of race or color, to draw up a freedom charter for the democratic South Africa of the future." Within months, the African National Conference accepted the proposal, and a council of the Congress of the People was created, with Chief Lutuli as chairman and Walter Sisulu and Yusuf Kachalia as joint secretaries. The Congress of the People was to create a set of principles for the foundation of a new South Africa. Suggestions for a new constitution were to come from the people themselves, and ANC leaders all across the country were authorized to seek ideas in writing from everyone in their area. The charter would be a document born of the people. The Congress of the People represented one of the two main currents of thought operating within the organization. It seemed inevitable that the government would ban the ANC, and many argued that the organization must be prepared to operate underground and illegally. At the same time, we did not want to give up on the important public policies and activities that brought the ANC attention and mass support. The Congress of the People would be a public display of strength. Our dream for the Congress of the People was that it would be a landmark event in the history of the freedom struggle, a convention uniting all the oppressed and all the progressive forces of South Africa to create a clarion call for change. Our hope was that it would one day be looked upon with the same reverence as the founding convention of the ANC in 1912. We sought to attract the widest possible sponsorship and invited some 200 organizations, white, black, Indian, and colored, to send representatives to a planning conference at Tongaat, near Durban, in March of 1954. The National Action Council created there was composed of 8 members from each of the 4 sponsoring organizations. The chairman was Chief Luthuli, and the secretariat consisted of Walter Sisulu, later replaced by Oliver after Walter's banning forced him to resign, Yusuf Kachalia of the SAIC, Stanley Lollin of the South African Colored People's Organization, SACPO, and Lionel Bernstein of the Congress of Democrats, COD. Formed in Cape Town in September of 1953 by colored leaders and trade unionists, SACPO was the belated offspring of the struggle to preserve the colored vote in the Cape and sought to represent colored interests. SACPO's founding conference was addressed by Oliver Tambo and Yusuf Kachalia. Inspired by the Defiance Campaign, the COD was formed in late 1952 as a party for radical, left-wing, anti-government whites. The COD, though small and limited mainly to Johannesburg and Cape Town, had an influence disproportionate to its numbers. Its members, such as Michael Harmel, Bram Fischer, and Rusty Bernstein, were eloquent advocates of our cause. The COD closely identified itself with the ANC and the SAIC, and advocated a universal franchise and full equality between black and white. We saw the COD as a means whereby our views could be put directly to the white public. The COD served an important symbolic function for Africans. Blacks who had come into the struggle because they were anti-white discovered that there were indeed whites of goodwill who treated Africans as equals. The National Action Council invited all participating organizations and their followers to send suggestions for a freedom charter. Circulars were sent out to townships and villages all across the country. "If you could make the laws, what would you do?" they said. "How would you set about making South Africa a happy place for all the people who live in it?" Some of the flyers and leaflets were filled with the poetic idealism that characterized the planning. "We call the people of South Africa black and white. Let us speak together of freedom. Let the voices of all the people be heard, and let the demands of all the people for the things that will make us free be recorded. Let the demands be gathered together in a great charter of freedom." The call caught the imagination of the people. Suggestions came in from sports and cultural clubs, church groups, ratepayers' associations, women's organizations, schools, trade union branches. They came on serviettes, on paper torn from exercise books, on scraps of foolscap, on the backs of our own leaflets. It was humbling to see how the suggestions of ordinary people were often far ahead of the leaders. The most commonly cited demand was for one man, one vote. There was a recognition that the country belongs to all those who have made it their home. The ANC branches contributed a great deal to the process of writing the charter, and in fact the 2 best drafts came from Durban and Pietermaritzburg. A combination of these drafts was then circulated to different regions and committees for comments and questions. The charter itself was drafted by a small committee of the National Action Council and reviewed by the ANC's National Executive Committee. The charter would be presented at the Congress of the People and each of its elements submitted to the delegates for approval. In June, a few days before the Congress was scheduled, a small group of us reviewed the draft. We made few changes, as there was little time, and the document was already in good shape. The Congress of the People took place at Cliptown, a multiracial village on a scrap of veld, a few miles southwest of Johannesburg, on two clear, sunny days, June 25th and 26th, 1955. More than 3,000 delegates braved police intimidation to assemble and approve the final document. They came by car, bus, truck, and foot. Although the overwhelming number of delegates were black, there were more than 300 Indians, 200 coloreds, and 100 whites. I drove to Cliptown with Walter. We were both under banning orders, so we found a place at the edge of the crowd where we could observe without mixing in or being seen. The crowd was impressive, both in its size and in its discipline. Freedom volunteers wearing black, green, and yellow armbands met the delegates and arranged for their seating. There were old women and young wearing Congress skirts, Congress blouses, Congress dokis, scarves, old men and young wearing Congress armbands and Congress hats. Signs everywhere said, "Freedom in our lifetime. Long live the struggle." The platform was a rainbow of colors. White delegates from the COD, Indians from the SAIC, colored representatives from SACPO, all sat in front of a replica of a four-spoked wheel representing the four organizations of the Congress Alliance. White and African police and members of the special branch milled around, taking photographs, writing in notebooks, and trying unsuccessfully to intimidate the delegates. There were dozens of songs and speeches. Meals were served. The atmosphere was both serious and festive. On the afternoon of the first day, the charter was read aloud, section by section, to the people in English, Sesotho, and Xhosa. After each section, the crowd shouted its approval with cries of "Africa" and "Mayebuye." The first day of the Congress was a success. The second day was much like the first. Each section of the charter had been adopted by acclamation, and at 3:30, the final approval was to be voted when a brigade of police and special branch detectives brandishing Sten guns swarmed onto the platform. In a gruff, Afrikaans-accented voice, one of the police took the microphone and announced that treason was suspected and that no one was to leave the gathering without police permission. The police began pushing people off the platform and confiscating documents and photographs, even signs such as "Soup with meat" and "Soup without meat." Another group of constables armed with rifles formed a cordon around the crowd. The people responded magnificently by loudly singing. The delegates were then allowed to leave one by one, each person interviewed by the police and his or her name taken down. I had been on the outskirts of the crowd when the police raid began, and while my instinct was to stay and help, discretion seemed the wiser course, because I would have immediately been arrested and tossed in jail. An emergency meeting had been called in Johannesburg, and I made my way back there. As I returned to Johannesburg, I knew that this raid signaled a harsh new turn on the part of the government. Though the Congress of the People had been broken up, the charter itself became a great beacon for the liberation struggle. Like other enduring political documents such as the American Declaration of Independence, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, and the Communist Manifesto, the Freedom Charter is a mixture of practical goals and poetic language. It extols the abolition of racial discrimination and the achievement of equal rights for all. It welcomes all who embrace freedom to participate in the making of a democratic, non-racial South Africa. It captured the hopes and dreams of the people and acted as a blueprint for the liberation struggle and the future of the nation. The preamble reads, "We, the people of South Africa, declare for all our country and the world to know that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white,
and that no government can justly claim authority unless it is based on the will of the people. That our people have been robbed of their birthright to land, liberty, and peace by a form of government founded on injustice and inequality. That our country will never be prosperous or free until all our people live in brotherhood, enjoying equal rights and opportunities. That only a democratic state based on the will of the people can secure to all their birthright without distinction of color, race, sex, or belief. And therefore we, the people of South Africa, black and white, together, equals countrymen and brothers. Adopt this freedom charter, and we pledge ourselves to strive together, sparing nothing of our strength and courage, until the democratic changes here set out have been won. The charter then lays out the requirements for a free and democratic South Africa. The people shall govern. Every man and woman shall have the right to vote for and stand as a candidate for all bodies which make laws. All the people shall be entitled to take part in the administration of the country. The rights of the people shall be the same regardless of race, color, or sex. All bodies of minority rule, advisory boards, councils, and authorities shall be replaced by democratic organs of self-government. All national groups shall have equal rights. There shall be equal status in the bodies of state, in the courts and in the schools for all national groups and races. All national groups shall be protected by law against insults to their race and national pride. All people shall have equal rights to use their own language and to develop their own folk culture and customs. The preaching and practice of national, race, or color discrimination and contempt shall be a punishable crime. All apartheid laws and practices shall be set aside. The people shall share in the country's wealth. The national wealth of our country, the heritage of all South Africans, shall be restored to the people. The mineral wealth beneath the soil, the banks and monopoly industry, shall be transferred to the ownership of the people as a whole. All other industries and trade shall be controlled to assist the well-being of the people. All people shall have equal rights to trade where they choose, to manufacture and to enter all trades, crafts, and professions. The land shall be shared among those who work it. Restriction of land ownership on racial basis shall be ended, and all the land redivided amongst those who work it, to banish famine and land hunger. Some in the ANC, particularly the Africanist contingent, who were anti-communist and anti-white, objected to the charter as being a design for a radically different South Africa from the one the ANC had called for throughout its history. They claimed the charter favored a socialist order and believed the COD and white communists had had a disproportionate influence on its ideology. In June 1956, in the monthly journal Liberation, I pointed out that the charter endorsed private enterprise and would allow capitalism to flourish among Africans for the first time. The charter guaranteed that when freedom came, Africans would have the opportunity to own their own businesses in their own names, to own their own houses and property. In short, to prosper as capitalists and entrepreneurs. The Charter does not speak about the eradication of classes and private property, or public ownership of the means of production, or promulgate any of the tenets of scientific socialism. The clause discussing the possible nationalization of the mines, the banks, and monopoly industries was an action that needed to be taken if the economy was not to be solely owned and operated by white businessmen. The Charter was, in fact, a revolutionary document precisely because the changes it envisioned could not be achieved without radically altering the economic and political structure of South Africa. It was not meant to be capitalist or socialist, but a melding together of the people's demands to end the oppression. In South Africa, to merely achieve fairness, one had to destroy apartheid itself, for it was the very embodiment of injustice. Chapter 21.
In early September 1955, my bans expired. I had last had a holiday in 1948, when I was an untested lightweight in the ANC, with few responsibilities beyond attending meetings in the Transvaal Executive and addressing the odd public gathering. Now, at the age of 38, I had reached the light heavyweight division and carried more pounds and more